ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Hello, it's Lisa Leong from This Working Life, helping to make your work life better with advice from the world's top experts, like psychotherapist Esther Perel.
Many conflicts are about power. Power is when I dismiss what you're bringing up. Power is when I magnify a problem.
And Professor Adam Grant.
We need to take our critics and our cheerleaders and turn them into coaches.
Free coaching! This Working Life on ABC Radio National and anytime on ABC Listen.
Picture this. You and your twin sister are called to a family meeting where your parents tell you they're splitting up. Now, they want to have a clean break, no shared custody. Instead, each child will live permanently with one of the parents. And the way to decide which kid will live with which adult? Well, how about rolling a dice? I'm Claire Nichols, and this is The Book Show, where I bring you conversations with your favourite fiction authors. The Australian diplomat turned novelist Ian Kemmish will join me soon. He's written a page-turner inspired by his experience in the Balkans in the 1990s. But first, let's get back to those parents deciding their children's future with a roll of the dice. Now, this is the cruel and funny start to A Rising of the Lights, the new novel by Australian writer Steve Toltz. Steve famously shortlisted for the Booker Prize for his very first novel, A Fraction of the Whole. Hi, Steve.
Hi, Claire. Thanks for having me.
It's a pleasure. But this idea of rolling a dice to see which child will live with which parent, it's brutal.
Yeah, look, it is. And it serves a few purposes in the book. But the book is sort of, it's this book that lives at the edge of consciousness in a way. So there's all these kind of things that happen. Like there's characters that get PTSD from a dream. There's sleepwalking, sleep talking, hypnosis. And a lot of it is about kind of free will. And rolling a dice to decide one's fate early in life is probably a good way to do that. And it's, yeah, some people find it dark, some people find it funny.
Yeah, I think I found it a bit of both. But I want people to get a bit of a sense of the tone and of the relationship between these parents, who are probably some of my favourite characters in the book. Can you read a little bit, just from this prologue here, where the parents have just rolled the dice? Can you read to us what comes next?
Sure. My father dragged a large red suitcase from the back of a cupboard. My mother shot him a hard stare. That's mine. He pulled it behind his back, holding it tightly. I was the one who paid for it. With our money, that I stole, while I was carrying your child. It went on like that. They debated the ownership of this battered suitcase that seemed to have disproportionate sentimental value to these notoriously unsentimental creatures. My father claimed she only liked the red suitcase because it matched her eyes. My mother said that was a good joke, but the suitcase was mauve, not red. Let's agree to disagree. I never agreed to that. My father eventually won the argument by yanking the suitcase from her hand, breathing heavily and retreating to pack. A border had been erected between us. We were all strangers to each other now.
And that was my first laugh out loud of the book, Steve, was let's agree to disagree. I never agreed to that because this book is funny and sad at the same time. Is this kind of the Steve Toltz trademark?
I guess so. I mean, I think that the style in which I write, which is kind of darkly humorous or, you know, dark comedy, blackly funny, however you want to describe it, is just the kind of default style that I have. It's sort of like asking someone to describe their odor. It's just, it's very hard. This is the way it sort of comes out. And I guess it's kind of the way I see the world.
Why is being miserable funny?
Well, I don't know if being miserable is funny, but I think if you can't find the humor in difficult circumstances, then the misery will just be compounded. You know, I've probably made a living out of my self-defense mechanism.
Okay, well, look, tell me how this book started. I want to know what was going on in your life. What was on your mind when you sat down to write A Rising of the Lights?
Yeah, good question. I wanted to write about, there's a lot about loneliness in this book, and I wanted to write about that. I also had written three books about fear. My first book was about the fear of death. The second one was about the fear of suffering. And the third book was about sort of the fear of the opinions of other people. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I kind of realized that what I'm writing about essentially, or like my beat, is just kind of like the human mind and why we behave the way that we do. And I realized that there is this kind of explanatory gap between what we know and what we can't know about ourselves. And another way to put it is the book's kind of about the opaque nature of self-knowledge. Just, you know, and I decided to do that through the character of Russell Wilson, who's my character, and I wanted to do it over the course of 1 year. So he's having a very strange year. The book begins in the middle of this quiet collapse. I mean, after the prologue, we sort of jump sort of 40 years or so into the future, and his job, his marriage, his relationship with his parents is all coming apart. He's a former therapist trained to understand other people's minds, who turns out to be almost completely blind to his own. He's kind of pushed into this sort of forced solitude, and from there into this kind of uneasy search for purpose, sort of a form of self-discovery. I always loved novels, and I wanted to write a novel, like one of my favorite novels, Steppenwolf, where, you know, someone discovers their personality might not be stable, and the rest of the book is them trying to survive that realization.
I love Russell's parents. After that prologue where we meet them and they split the kids up, we then find out as an adult that Russell is in touch with his parents. He visits them at their respective aged care homes, you know, once a month. What is Russell's adult relationship like with his mum and dad?
Well, they were never great parents to begin with. First of all, his father obviously lost him in a game of dice, and then disappeared out of his childhood, sort of coming back sort of, I think, when he's probably late 20s or something like that. And then his mother had a kind of standoffish relationship with him anyway. And, you know, he grudgingly goes and visits them once a month. He basically visits them exactly once a month on the same day, visiting his father maybe about 10 minutes before visiting hours are over at the nursing home. And that's where they are when they announce that they never want to see him again.
And why don't they want to see him?
Well, the mother does it first, and her idea is that she doesn't want him to witness her decline. She can feel that she's a bit of a burden. She also might be just doing it to spite him. It's a little unclear.
There's this line in the book that really jumped out at me. It sucks that the cure for loneliness causes loneliness. I found this so powerful, you know, this idea that our need for love and connection with people means it hurts so much when we lose it. Can you talk to me a little bit about that line?
I've kind of always been writing about the four like central concerns of existential thought and existential psychotherapy. So basically, the four things are that death, that we know that we're going to die, we have an awareness of death. And then there's freedom, that means that we're free, but we're responsible for our choices. The third one is meaninglessness, mm-hmm. that the life is kind of meaningless, but we have to create our own meaning. And I've written about those three with my other three books. But the fourth one is about isolation, and mm-hmm. that nobody but us can finally experience our world. And, you know, and even when we're together with someone, we're sort of still alone, and because we die alone. And and then of course, at the same time, you know, according to a lot of discourse, you know, that loneliness is a sort of public health crisis as a modern lifestyle problem. You know, whether there's a loneliness epidemic or not, I'm not sure. But, you know, even in the US, the Surgeon General declares loneliness, you know, a public health crisis comparable to smoking and obesity. So it's pretty, I guess there's also like, there's loneliness, solitude, isolation and aloneness. They're not all the same thing. So loneliness is intrinsic to human consciousness. But and every character in this novel experiences it in some form or another.
Mm. And when we're talking about loneliness in this day and age, it seems like, you know, in an increasingly digital world, perhaps it's easier to be lonely than ever before. There's a lot in this novel about tech and AI. Also, this idea that we're perhaps becoming redundant, Steve. Tell me what you were seeing in the world that made you want to write about this.
Yeah, it's pretty funny. I'm sort of have the curse of being prescient, but by only about 30 seconds. So for my last novel, Here Goes Nothing, I wrote about a pandemic, but I wrote about that in like 2019. But by the time I'd finished the book, we were already out of the pandemic. And in the same way, I kind of wrote about a lot of this AI stuff in sort of when I started the novel in 2022. So it was sort of about a year before ChatGPT came out. So it wasn't that I'd seen it. It was coming, you know, the AI field has been studied for a long time. And I mean, I read books about AI before this new kind of wave of actual AI. The only thing that's different is kind of the collapse of the time horizons. Like, I was writing about something in which people still thought it was 50 years away, 5 years ago. And so I thought I was writing a book in this era, which I kind of sort of called pre-futurism, which is, I felt that we were always living on the precipice of the future where everything seemed about to change. Oh, like, you know, self-driving cars are going to flood the world. There's going to be, you know, AIs, all these kind of things, but it never actually eventuates. But I was wrong. It's coming really fast now. And I feel like we're in an era not unlike, you know, I think we're going to traverse what was kind of 1870 to 1945, but we're going to do it in about 10 years, you know, where the cities all became electrified. I think, I think that AI is interesting because, fiction has shown two versions of the future in the past. You know, you've got George Orwell's 1984, which was kind of this idea of totalitarianism, and, you know, and then you have the Brave New World, which was an idea of sort of contentment and pleasure and distraction being the thing that controls us. But with that, there's another kind of human motivation that AI taps into, which is just our love, addiction and need for convenience. And so I think that what I can see happening is that, you know, AI sort of removes a lot of the friction to life, and, you know, where it kind of genuine risk of forgetting how to function without assistance, which is dependency, not oppression. I guess we risk being helped into redundancy.
Tell me about the world you've created for this book. What kind of tech exists in the world of our narrator, Russell?
Look, it's 5 minutes into the future, really. it's sort of AI has started to replace jobs just faster than it has now. So jobs are starting to be replaced. You know, they're still trying it out. There's a scene where he has family therapy with his parents and an AI kind of analyst chatbot named Freudo. Yeah, there's self-driving cars on the road. So it's really just 5 minutes from now.
Yeah, and it's certainly not, you know, you're not writing dystopian future here, Steve Tolz.
No, it's not that.
What are your concerns when it comes to your job as an author? What are your concerns about AI?
I don't know if I'm that concerned. I definitely, there are sort of taboos at the moment about people using AI to write books. And, you know, there was just a big case of them, you know, recently about a novel that got pulled because they found AI. But I mean, knowing what I know about people, I think these taboos are going to last about 5 minutes. I mean, nobody batted an eye when just about every musician lost their livelihood through selling sort of CDs when first Napster and people were pirating music, and then they just sort of gave in to Spotify. Similarly, I just don't think anybody's going to care too much about human authors. I mean, obviously, there's the idea at the moment is that anybody could just sort of type something in and have AI do it for them. But of course, you have to have some talent there to begin with, because, you know, a million multiplied by zero is just still zero. Mm-hmm. And so I think, you know, the market might be flooded with garbage, but eventually I can imagine some intelligent, creative, well-read young person is not going to want to spend their 10,000 hours writing. It is just going to start producing, like working with AI and doing it. And you know, whether the reader will care, I think not.
That's so depressing, Steve. I don't know. I have to believe that you novelists, you're doing something novel. You are doing something. You're tapping into a sense of humanity that surely an algorithm cannot.
Yeah, look, I think it will be very difficult because, you know, obviously, you know, what constitutes originality is putting together the unexpected, and that's something that an algorithm can't do. So on its own, it can't. But even like, you've seen, say, the filmmaker Darren Aronofsky start to use AI for film. And, you know, once you get people of that caliber just starting to use AI, I think that's where we'll be competing. I mean, I'm sort of immune because I still write by longhand.
Wow.
So I still kind of, which is just a habit I developed early on. And so there's no temptation for me to use AI when I'm composing, because I'm obviously just doing it on a notebook, you know, I don't have a computer with me when I write. I just think it's very short-sighted to imagine that us human novelists won't be competing with, I guess, not AI so much, but cyborgs. You know, we're all sort of partially cyborgs now anyway. Like, you know, you see people walking around with phones in their hands. That's just one step away from having that phone implanted. So I think that we'll be competing with cyborgs. That's fine.
It's fine. You know, our narrator Russell in this novel, he gets a gig for a while as a school guidance counsellor, which is pretty funny. He's talking to all these kids who are pretty zombified from all the time on their phones, saying to them, oh, don't aspire to that. You're not going to have any future. You know, there's no jobs for you kids. I mean, what would you be telling a young Steve Tolz now? Would you be saying, yep, stick with the novel writing, or maybe go for something else?
I mean, I would never advise anyone to write a novel. You know, it takes too long. But no, I mean, on the other hand, like it turns out that maybe things like poetry, philosophy, fiction, music, performance, sport, these are the last vestiges of the human. And it's very hard to see into the future. Like, we really don't know what the world is going to be like in, say, 25 years. But there is, you know, as jobs disappear and professions that we thought would be immune will disappear, it may just turn out that all the most human things are the things that we should do. Like, you know, maybe don't do science, maybe like philosophy and the humanities is going to have a kind of a real moment. Mm. And writing will be, you know, I think it'll be niche, but I think that writing novels, writing poetry, writing music, I think those things may be something that is going to last.
Is writing fun for you, Steve?
Yeah, look, it is. And I think that for me, it's really the pleasure principle. I feel very fortunate that I get a lot of pleasure out of almost sort of 95% basically of the process. Like, I like dreaming it up. I like writing the first bad draft. I like improving that draft. I like, you know, working with an editor and sort of fixing it up. I just like the whole thing. I'm not as fast as I would like to be, but I really enjoy it.
Steve Toltz, your book is A Rising of the Lights. It's published by Penguin Books. It's been great to chat again today.
Great to chat with you.
On ABC Radio National, this is The Book Show. And Ian Kemmish is here now. He's a former Australian diplomat and now a novelist. And he's lent into his diplomatic background, particularly his memories of war in Yugoslavia in the 90s, for his first work of fiction. It's called Two Islands. Hi, Ian.
Great to be with you.
So as a diplomat, Ian, where have you worked?
I think you could divide it up pretty evenly between Australia's immediate neighbourhood, the Asia Pacific, and Europe. My head of mission jobs were variously in Port Moresby, Papua New Guinea, where I was High Commissioner, and Germany, where I was ambassador. I was also accredited there to Switzerland and other places. But, you know, before I became an ambassador, I was posted variously in Southeast Asia, again in Europe, and I had this job that you just mentioned in your intro, formerly attached to the embassy in Vienna in the 1990s, and that's where my family lived, it's where the house was. But my job was very much focused on the western half, if you like, of former Yugoslavia, by which I mean Bosnia, Croatia, and Slovenia. And it was a time of extraordinary events. It was a time that in some ways we seem to have, well, many of us seem to have forgotten a little bit about. And, it was an important time in my life. Met a lot of really inspiring people, saw some pretty difficult things, and it lingered with me.
Mm. I mean, what was your day-to-day role during that period of time? What were you actually doing?
Well, to begin with, I was the eyes and ears of the Australian government at a time when there was actually quite a lot of focus on that region. The conflict was very much underway. Efforts were being made by the international community to bring about an end to the awful killing and the slaughter that had been taking place through the early 90s in Bosnia in particular, but also Croatia. It was a time when the Australian government probably had more skin in the game than most people might appreciate. You know, we Australians were welcoming, as by far the most significant proportion of our refugee and humanitarian immigration intake, from the Balkans and particularly from Bosnia. You know, it was something like 40% of all the people who came under those categories came from there. We also had and still have very, very substantial Serbian, Croatian, Bosnian, Macedonian, and other communities from that place, and that gave another reason for Australia to be focused on it. And finally, we had a government of the time, a minister called Gareth Evans, who really believed that middle powers could play a role in the big international issues of the day through the multilateral system. So, you know, all of that required information and analysis. And also, you know, I'd speak for Australia from time to time, had a small aid program, but I was all over the place. And I guess I was the person that ultimately the government was relying on for fresh understanding and knowledge of what was happening there.
What kind of things did you see?
I saw some really inspiring things, as I said earlier. You know, Sarajevo during the siege, I could tell you all about flak jackets and helmets and driving down Sniper Alley and all that stuff. Wow. But actually, the thing that really stands out in memory is the memory of particularly women, people generally, but particularly women, emerging from, you know, the sometimes rubble of their homes, dressed for the day, made up beautifully. The pride in them was extraordinary to behold, the determination to keep on living amidst, you know, sporadic artillery and sniper fire from the hills around was truly inspiring. I also was only a day or so behind the Croatian forces when they swept into and drove out Serbs from a pocket of Croatia called Krajina. In the summer of 1995, so I saw some pretty difficult things then. You know, the left behind, the elderly, the human cost of this conflict. So I saw all that, but the things that have stayed with me have been more on the inspirational side than the dark side, I have to say.
Well, that's a wonderful thing. I mean, this is a pretty complicated conflict because it was a conflict with three sides, Ian. Mm-hmm. Was it ever a simple matter of these are the good guys and these are the bad guys?
No. People often, and I understand why, sought to reduce it to that kind of thing. There were victims on all sides. I have to say that the Bosnian Muslims emerge, and probably rightly, as the clearest victims of the period. But look, you know, it's not coincidence that the backstory in my book does feature, well, it features two bad things. It's not altogether a book that's about bad things. These things lie in the background. And my point is one of them, based firmly on a real set of developments, involves an atrocity committed by Serbs against Croatians in the very, very early years of the conflict, and the other involves an atrocity committed by Croatians against Bosnian Muslims. And, you know, I'm not trying to make a huge local agenda point here, but in the end, if there were villains on any side, it was particularly the politicians, the nationalist politicians who, for their own purposes, manipulated and fanned the flames of century-old resentment that does, for historical reasons, exist in that region between some of these groups that we lazily call ethnicities. I mean, they're not ethnicities; they're cultural groups. You know, they're as ethnically different from each other as Catholics and Protestants are in Northern Ireland. In other words, not at all.
Yeah. Ian Kemish, I'm so interested in your journey from diplomat to writer. It did occur to me that as a diplomat, you know, you're obviously dealing in facts, but it's also about crafting a narrative around those facts, right? Like, I'm interested to know how much storytelling is involved in diplomacy.
A lot. And I think you're onto something there, I have to say. Particularly, I think, as a head of mission, you get to that point of authority and a level of confidence that people have in you in the system. You're looking to influence particularly your own capital, your own ministers, your own prime minister, when it comes to the issues that you're dealing with in your country of location, in your location. And to do that, you're competing with a whole lot of other people who are trying to do the same thing. You have to tell your story in an interesting way and sometimes even in an entertaining way. And I used to find ways of doing that. Papua New Guinea seemed to generate lots of opportunity to do that, I have to say. So absolutely, you know, I think people who haven't been within the system couldn't be expected to understand it, but, you know, at least half your job is about managing your own side, if I can put it that way, you know, influencing your own government's thinking and approach when it comes to the issues that you're facing close up on a day-to-day basis.
So yeah, you've always had this storytelling ability, but I guess now with the shift into fiction, you can fully embrace it now, Ian. You can shake off any commitment to truth-telling, I guess. I mean, what does that feel like?
Oh, look, it's great. It's been a wonderful thing. As I think you know, it's my second book, but the first was, you know, nonfiction and probably closer to the kind of writing I used to do. And absolutely, there's a new creative freedom that comes with letting yourself go a little bit and creating characters. It's been a wonderful joy and a wonderful discovery in the process. The truth is, though, you know, particularly if you're talking about a time, as I am, it is anchored in truth and needs to be. You know, you need to get your facts right. My plot plays out, the contemporary plot, there's flashbacks, but the contemporary plot plays out through the northern spring and summer of 1997. And, you know, I wanted to be very clear about what was happening in the background and set up the temporal framework just right. The Blair election in the United Kingdom is taking place in the background, for example, and I wanted to make sure that the days were exactly right. And this is a matter of going to the calendar, checking this happened on that day, you know. Mm-hmm. If you're writing about a time and you don't want your former colleagues to pick apart your work, then you need to get your facts right.
And not only is the Blair election happening, I think it's important to say that you've nailed the music in 1997. We're listening to the Spice Girls. We're listening to Savage Garden. You cannot escape them at this moment in time.
No, absolutely. You know, it's Oasis v Blur. It's, you know, it's the whole shooting match. And, you know, I love that time. I was a guy in my early 30s and I've always loved music, still do, and it's a nice way to take people back to the time. You know, this is not a book that's all darkness, but it's a book that does try to say, listen, you remember the 90s? This was a time that we often think about as a time of golden innocence and, you know, the time between the fall of the wall and the coming of the jihad on September 11, when things were fine, and the Spice Girls. But actually, you know what? It was also a time that saw the death of Yugoslavia. It was also a time when the troubles in Northern Ireland peaked prior to the Good Friday Agreement. Mm. So the experience of some was not the experience of all, and that's part of the message of this book.
And the book is called Two Islands, and people are going to be surprised, Ian, to find we've been talking about Yugoslavia all that time, but the action in this book actually happens on an island in Scotland. Mm-hmm. Why are you writing about Scotland?
Well, what brings these places together is what I think of, and I hope readers find, is the central idea of the book, which is that idea of people carrying hidden histories into peaceful places, and ultimately encountering human kindness. If there's a summary of what I'm trying to do here, it's that. So my troubled souls, and ultimately there are two particularly, who are carrying history, and at least one of them from the region we've been talking about, assemble in the Hebrides, in the Western Islands of Scotland. Why there? Well, first of all, it's my mother's country. It's a place I love, and it's a place I know very well. So there's, you know, a real affection, and there's also, you know, that age-old principle, write what you know. Mm. So combining these two made sense in that way. There's more authenticity, again, than people might first expect about that idea that, you know, people with carrying trauma from the Balkans wash up on the edge of Europe, on the western edge of the Atlantic. Good friend of mine served as an investigator with the International Criminal Court, was more involved a bit later than the period I'm talking about, when the focus was on former Yugoslavia. He was more active during the Rwanda phase, if I can call it that. Anyway, I mean, early on in the development of this idea, I was having a conversation with him, and I mentioned this idea, and he said, you know what, I have taken witness statements from Rwandan survivors inside the Arctic Circle.
Wow.
And I said, holding my fingers together in the hope that he gave me the answer I was looking for, I said, why? And he said, because they run as far as they can. And I, you know, I was struck by it, but I also was having a little eureka moment inside because this was the idea that I had. So there's some authenticity to it. And like I say, this is where these troubled souls meet some, well, let's face it, extremely eccentric characters, but who are also kind. And, you know, by the way, more than half of them are based very firmly on members of my family or, you know, characters I have known. So there's some truth in it.
Okay, so we've got this young man who is fleeing. His name is Nico and he finds himself on these Scottish islands. Who is Nico? What has he lived through and why is he on the run?
This slowly unpeels early in the book, so I don't think it's too much of a reveal. Nico, ultimately, we discover before too long, is a survivor of, you know, an awful thing in Croatia in the early 90s. He has survived because he was pretty young. He was 16 at the time. The truth is there were many 16-year-old boys who were dragged along with the men and killed. There were other cases in other incidents where somebody was able to survive because of their relative youth, and Nico survived. Nico wants to tell his story. He's brave. He has been encouraged to tell his story by an Australian law enforcement figure, a woman called Anita, who is an AFP investigator working with the Hague Tribunal. There were many of them, by the way. But Nico is fearful. He has reasons to have bunked it, to have run. And he doesn't quite know what he's doing or where he's going. He's just ended up in this place, which is a long way from anything he knows. And he encounters these people and he can hardly understand what they're saying. You know, it's that encounter with the locals is something I feel is important.
And, you know, this is such a quiet island. At points it feels like there are only about three locals in this place. But one of them is this guy called Ronnie. He's an old man who's always helping others. Is this based on someone you know?
Not only is it based on someone I know, he actually bears the name of the actual person upon whom he's based. I sort of felt that in Ronnie Greenshill's case, I could get away with that. Ronnie was, you know, didn't have much family, the real Ronnie, I mean. And he passed away some years ago. He, like this Ronnie, he's not quite like this Ronnie, of course he's not, but like this Ronnie, he's somebody who was touched by his own experience with conflict and who found meaning in his life through helping other people, and that's Ronnie. So, you know, he's an important voice. There are four voices, and I think we've mentioned two so far. You know, Nico, Anita, our policewoman, and old Ronnie.
He is a lovely man, and the people on this island are inherently good people. Ian Kemish. And I know you've talked about this. You've said, I wanted to write a story about people doing good. I wanted to write a story about goodness. How radical is it to write a novel where the people are inherently good?
Yeah, it's interesting that people respond that way. It's lovely that people respond that way. I've actually had one of the lovely things about writing fiction is, I didn't know this, but you receive these lovely messages from people you've never met on, you know, Instagram and email and sometimes even text. Don't know how they get that number. But the people are responding to that point really well. And perhaps that says something about the state of the world, anxiety about some pretty awful things that we've seen here. But in my view, the truth is that good things are being done by people amidst all this all the time. And, you know, my experience of conflict situations is that people do help each other out. my experience of small communities, I'm sure this applies here in Australia in adversity, it certainly applies in the Western Islands of Scotland, is that people help each other out. My experience is that suspicion of strangers and even racism often doesn't survive contact between two individuals. And, you know, that's actually, I think, how the world largely is. And I think it's worth reminding ourselves of that.
Yeah, I loved that this book did that. Are you going to write more fiction, Ian?
Yeah, I am. I've got an idea for the next one. I haven't quite got going yet, but I've got an idea.
Well, I loved this first novel. It's called Two Islands. It's published by UQP. Ian Kemmish, it's been great to meet you today.
So nice to talk. Thanks so much.
The Book Show is made on the lands of the Wurundjeri and Whadjuk Noongar people. Thank you to producer Anita Barrow. Next time, poet, rapper and novelist Kay Tempest will be here to share his beautiful new book. Until then, I'm Claire Nichols, and make sure you're following The Book Show on ABC Listen.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.